This is CliffCentral.com.
Jessie Le Pen is the U.S. Charge d'affaires here in South Africa, and she has been in that role since the departure of our friend, Ambassador Patrick Gaspard. He left in 2016, and Jessie's been handling it all since then. I don't know how you managed to fit everything else in, including being a mom. It's a crazy life you lead.
Crazy, but good. I love living here. I'm so keen and into being in South Africa. I think my son is ready to live here forever.
Well, you know, the U.S. is a massive supporter of a lot of the good things that go on in South Africa. And I think a lot of people don't really take heed of these things because maybe they don't make the headlines as much as the controversial stuff. And I do think that there are a few of these I want to touch on during the course of our conversation. I've known Jessie for a little while now, and she really does a lot for South Africa that goes unheeded, that goes unmentioned. And I think that the US's involvement in this country as one of our biggest trading partners, as one of our allies in so many good things around the world, and as a country that has helped us to implement and to accelerate some of our own democratic processes over the years, particularly just post-apartheid when South Africa was finding its feet, has been instrumental. So I'm very, very happy to have you here, Jessie. It's nice to talk to you, and we've got lots to talk about. So first of all, congratulations on the new special relationship between the US and the UK. You've got a princess, an American princess.
We do. We're so excited. I was obsessed with the wedding. I wore a large hat and actually drank gin and tonics all day in honor of Harry and Meghan. Look, I think it's actually pretty terrific. I think that she's an extraordinary American export. She was a 12-year-old activist and feminist, and she's bringing a real American vibe to London and to the royal family. And I thought the wedding was terrific. It was a mix of cultures, from sort of horse-drawn carriage to an extraordinary gospel choir. I was really proud of the America that we showed the world that day.
I think Churchill and Roosevelt would have been proud of it too. It's like the ultimate achievement in race relations for the royal family, who haven't really been inclusive on that front before. It's a huge achievement in terms of British and American relations, with, you know, bloodlines being connected now. And I think this is a good thing. It may even make some Americans feel that King George III might not have been such a bad option 250 years ago.
Yes, this is we went from revolution to coup, silent coup. But we're really excited. I think it's great. And actually, I love that both of them are genuinely committed to using their power and their platforms for impact, including in Southern Africa. And so I'm excited about what they're going to do as a team.
I think so too. Let's start with all the things that you guys are involved in here in South Africa. And some of these, as I said earlier, don't get the mention they deserve. PEPFAR is the US President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. This is a massive, massive program. It involves a commitment of $6 billion so far in combating and fighting HIV/AIDS in South Africa. It includes government, civil society, medical, research communities. I mean, this is an incredible thing, and I don't think we're entirely aware of how much it impacts positively on people's lives. People who would have been given the death sentence some time ago are now alive because of PEPFAR.
Absolutely. As you say, we've spent $6 billion over the last 14 years. At this point, we're still at about $500 million a year and potentially more. I think there's a narrative that our funding has been cut or will be cut, and it's actually not the case. Ironically, a number of years ago, we had worked out a plan to reduce funding with the government of South Africa, but it's not a good decision. The epidemic still rages. It doesn't get the focus and the sense of urgency, but it's still not controlled, and the money is still important. And for me, what's important about the money is it's also part of a partnership. So we couldn't do what we do to help South Africans without big buy-in from the government. But similarly, they really need the support that we give. So I'll give an example. Sometimes we get asked, what's our plan for HIV/AIDS relief here? And our answer is always that our plan is the National Strategic Plan, that we are working closely and carefully and consistently with government. One, for me, really important thing that, though, has happened recently is President Ramaphosa's call to get an additional 2 million people on treatment. And that's crucial, right? Mm-hmm. Because you need that level of political will. And we haven't seen so clear and senior a call to get control of the epidemic. And we are at a moment when, without a vaccine, without a cure, we have that potentially. We know how to do it, but it's hard. And so we work to do it, to get 2 million more people on treatment.
So why do you think people are spreading around false narratives about funding being cut? Why do you think people are unaware of this in many areas of South African politics, society?
I think one, there's some level of fatigue that the country has struggled for two decades with HIV, mm-hmm. and people want to turn away from it because it's such an unfortunate part of the South African story, but it truly is this generation's struggle. And so I think looking away from it doesn't solve the problem, quite the opposite. We know that, in fact, stigma and hiding contributes to the spread of HIV. I think that's one thing. I think also South Africa has an extraordinary history and politics that is proud and independent, doesn't see itself as needing assistance. But I think the scale of a problem like HIV is such that anybody would need assistance. And for me, what's unique about the HIV work here is how it contributes to the global struggle against HIV, that the kind of research we do here is unique. It's cutting edge. So we work with UCT, with UWC, our National Institutes of Health, and we are doing not just vaccine trials, but far more cutting edge and additional research that will be part of solving HIV/AIDS globally. So in that respect, I wish South Africa told the story, because I think they have a positive story to tell about how they are contributing with us globally.
Well, here it is, late and probably a small consolation, but thanks. You know, I mean, it's nice when we find out that we're being helped by the US and we're completely ungrateful for it for years. So there it is. Let's just talk about US aid as well, because this is a huge part of what you guys do. And there's a huge department of people in Pretoria who take care of this. What is the main thrust of US aid and what does it mean?
So three pieces that we're doing here. One is the health under PEPFAR.
Right.
The other is...
Do they administer all of that?
So USAID and the Centers for Disease Control, what we call CDC, they are the main implementers. But we also, I should say, have great, great PEPFAR money being spent for Peace Corps. We've got something like 130 Peace Corps volunteers across the country. And what's terrific about them is they work at the most local, most community level, really connecting at a basic level between Americans and South Africans and bringing preventive HIV education to rural communities. So that's the other piece
one.
Of PEPFAR.
Okay.
But for USAID, so health is key. And then the other pieces are basic education and then also inclusive growth and employment training. The last one is particularly exciting. We work through a South African organization called Harambee, and we have a relatively new grant with them for $3.5 million over 3 years.
Right.
And they have been really successful, in part because they work both with young people and with employers, recognizing that it's employers who know what kinds of jobs are needed. And they train and they place, and they've got 40,000 placements in the last several years and are planning now on an additional 45,000. And I have visited Harambee a couple of times and been really inspired by the work that they're doing and the way that they treat the young people, not just as beneficiaries of assistance, but as part of the solution to the country's problem, so that the enormous number of young people, it's not a burden for South Africa. It's also an opportunity. And Harambee really brings that ethos to their work while also using really impressive data models to identify skills and needs.
So these are people who've already been placed in jobs? Because we have a lot of discussions in South Africa about unemployment. And I actually had this conversation with someone on my show just the other day, that unemployment isn't this this complicated thing where everybody just gets a job because that's what we need to do to live as human beings. You need to provide value. And sometimes it's hard to connect that employer with the employee that they're prospectively looking for. So is this largely what they do?
So I think you're right that the scale of the problem is such that different kinds of interventions are going to be needed.
Mm-hmm.
Some, right, there's a limit to how many jobs are going to be created without more growth.
Right.
And so that's certainly got to be addressed, and I think we are part of that with the government. But in addition, what the research has found is that if a young person has never had a job, it's very hard to get a first job, that they don't even know how to pitch up to an interview, and they don't even know how to do
present
work.
Themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose those soft skills are sometimes the things that you don't learn from books. They're the things that you don't learn from teachers. They're not the things that people prepare you for, and they can get you in or out of a job.
Absolutely, and if they've grown up in a family without people working, they haven't observed it. So Harambee's really focused on that and also helping people figure out what they want to do, what they can do. So it's a terrific project that we are happy to be supporting and are happy to join a lot of big South African businesses in our support for Harambee.
I was interested to read that you're involved in trying to get South African energy up and running in terms of solar and trying to get behind solar farms and that kind of thing. How much involvement is there from the embassy and how much funding is put towards this? What kind of interest do people have here for it?
A huge interest. South Africa's energy needs will only grow, and U.S. technology is a great fit for those needs. We've been engaged in terms of feasibility studies for urban solar farms, and also, recently, the Minister of Energy announced new independent power projects that would go on grid, and major U.S. companies are part of that. And the result in terms of megawatts on the grid, increased value in terms of the economy, also in terms of rural communities, is massive. A lot of the big projects are also going to be in underserved rural communities, particularly in Northern Cape, which are going to benefit from jobs.
Well, there's so much sun there. I mean, you got to harness the stuff. What's the point of wasting it every day, you know?
This is I think, for us, like an absolute win-win.
By the way,
we've got technology. South Africa needs it.
I heard you use two words there that just tell me how much has changed in the U.S. in the last 2 years. You went, huge. There is a huge need for this. And you said, great American technology. So I can see that there's a, you know, some of the stuff from over there is spilling over here into our embassy. It's good news.
But that's also the New Yorker.
You're a New Yorker.
We always go
yeah.
big. Go big or go home if you're from New York.
Right. Damn straight. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about Beyond Advocacy. I don't know what this is. The Beyond Advocacy Fund, which is part of what? Business Leadership South Africa?
Exactly. So it's a partnership with us and BLSA.
BLSA is a whole bunch of business leaders who've got together to try and drive the economy forward, to try and bring in positive changes where they can, cooperate with government, try to get the private sector involved in how government makes its decisions. So hopefully some very positive moves there. And I know that they've spoken out in the last couple of months against a lot of things that they didn't support, and they've spoken for a lot of things that they did. Is this not potentially a tricky area for you? Because business and government are sometimes on opposite sides of the fence.
So our focus with them has been very much identifying innovative small grant programs that will in some ways address the gaps between business and government. We have had great success and are in fact planning to extend the award to them For us, we've got to be partnering with business as well as government to have meaningful economic impact here. The issues are such that only government and only business can really scale solutions. So we are happily partnering with both.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to do. I imagine another thing that's not easy to do is to always walk this line where you don't seem to be interfering in things, but where you're supporting things that, that are universally helpful and in line with the things that we have in common as countries, right?
Absolutely. And we've got some 600 US companies here right. operating in South Africa. So from our perspective, there are certain policy changes that we would advocate for because we think they're good for our companies. But in many ways, a lot of those policy changes are generally good for business, whether it's American or South African. That's in terms of primarily in terms of transparency.
Right. What about the one thing that South Africa really has in spade loads and that we probably take for granted a lot of the time? We've got an incredibly diverse wildlife species array. We've got these beautiful parks, which people from the US always want to come and visit. People from all over the world want to come and visit. And sometimes we're not great custodians of all of that. I'm saying a little bit of self-criticism here is never a bad thing. But the US, obviously, you know, where you can, you get involved in some of these initiatives. How exactly do you do that? What is the dance that you guys are doing with us there?
We've gotten really involved in the last couple of years, I think, from two perspectives. One, recognizing the significance of illegal trade globally and the security threat it poses, but also the value of biodiversity. And South Africa has that in spades. So as the mom of a nine-year-old boy, I do a lot of wildlife watching and love it. That's like on my weekend part. My weekday part, however, is a couple pieces. One, we've got law enforcement agencies working with South African law enforcement partners and really trying to get a handle on the criminal networks that run this.
Because it's international, so it affects
Completely.
Everybody. And you guys might have information that we don't have. You know, you might know things that we don't.
I think we've been able in that respect to help in connecting South African law enforcement with Asian law enforcement agencies because that's where so much of the demand is coming from. Mm-hmm. So we've got to do the law enforcement piece, which is hard. The levels of cooperation and information sharing required, that's real. The other piece, though, is making sure communities around the parks are involved in benefiting from tourism and that lost livelihood is replaced. And so we look at it from both sides, both from the perspective of community development and also law enforcement.
I have a few friends who have been involved in the Mandela Washington Fellowship, which is a terrific initiative. I've seen some of them travel to the U.S., meet with the great and the good, go to very interesting discussions and presentations, and they themselves come back full of information and full of genuine ideas of collegiality and how we can help each other and, you know, what the U.S. and South Africa can do together, which you don't hear too much of really anywhere in the world of international relations, because so much of it is plagued by immediate UN conflicts, issues around what country X or Y are doing, whether or not we support each other, what kind of power block we belong to, for want of a better term. But these guys and girls, they go over there and they take part in real programs where we effectively swap knowledge.
I love this program. I think this program is great. We just last week did the kickoff event where we basically had the send-off for 46 South African Mandela Washington Fellows. It's a lot of people, 46.
How do you choose them?
Oh my, it's so competitive. I am have to tell you, I went to Harvard as an undergraduate, and it is more competitive to be a Mandela Washington Fellow than to go to Harvard. I'm not sure it was true in my day, but
wow.
Anyway. Yeah, so incredibly competitive. So the people who are selected are amazing. South Africa does really well on gender representation, we are also really mindful of pulling from all communities. So from all the provinces, from urban and rural, they're either in civil society or government or entrepreneur and business. And these 46 and, you know, the 67 last year, I mean, the numbers are pretty amazing every year. And every year the cohort kind of blows you away about what they're already doing and what they can do. And that's our input. That's our intervention, taking, you said big to huge, going from really amazing to awesome, because that's the level of play for South Africa's young leaders.
What's your best outcome with each of these people once they come back to South Africa?
I'd say best outcome is if they were impacting at the community level, they're impacting at the city level. They were impacting at the city level, they're impacting at the national level. We also see them begin to impact at the international level because it's a Pan-African program. So you'll get a Zimbabwean nuclear scientist and a South African physicist collaborating, and all of a sudden you're working in a totally different space. And honestly, a space that would not have happened without this program, because this program is actually connecting Africans with one another and connecting them with the U.S. They spend 6 weeks in America and across. Not everybody goes to New York City. People are in Iowa and in Texas, as well as Chicago and Washington, D.C.
We'll talk about your career in a minute, because you spent a lot of time in Washington. I want to hear about that, as well as in other parts of the world that I want to talk about. But while we're on the issue of education and kind of leadership, one of the things that I'm very pleased to see that there's an overlap of is we're very good friends at the African Leadership Academy here at Cliff Central, and I know that you guys are very big supporters of them as well. And I've met some of the students from the African Leadership Academy, and these are some of the brightest people in the whole of this continent, and they come from very far-flung corners of it. All of them making massive changes, massive impact everywhere they are. But then they come to South Africa and they collaborate, and it's quite incredible to see that that combined will and that combined force that they can exert on their own countries. Sometimes they bring about changes which you would think unbelievable before you meet them. And you see these people and you think, wow, I can completely understand why you're having the impact that you are. They really are incredible.
Absolutely. We had a couple weeks ago, five quite senior American senators were visiting, and we took them to see ALA, and they were blown away. It wasn't so much the young people being impressed by our senators as our senators being impressed by Africa's young people. So for me, what I love about the U.S. involvement there is you have, in fact, at the leadership, Americans who were part of it from the beginning, working with Africans. They had been students together and really built a vision. Then there was U.S. government lending that gave ALA some of the money it needed when it couldn't get commercial loans. And then a huge number of private American donors who see the value and as individuals are committed.
Wow. So a lot of this is funded by the U.S., not just in terms of government money, but private money.
Mm-hmm. But it's individuals who say, this is a value. I am supportive. I am in. And what I love actually is there is a lot of U.S. support, but it fundamentally feels like an African institution, right, which I think is exactly right. Yeah, it's the right combo.
The people who are in this program are just they're blood and sweat and soil African. That's what they care about. Okay, I want to talk about you for a little bit, can we?
Yeah. Who doesn't want to talk about themselves? What do you want to know?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you diplomats get a little bit uncomfortable when we start asking you questions about yourselves. So first of all, I looked over the things that you've done before you were posted to South Africa, and you really have been everywhere, but you've been in Africa before. Mm-hmm. In fact, you had quite a lot to do with Kigali. And it was obviously post all of the very messy stuff that happened in that part of the world around the early 90s. But it's become a place where everybody is hugely excited. I mean, Rwanda is one of the places that South Africans are excited to visit, to do trade with. I hear that they've got a thriving tech hub that's growing over there. I hear that the people of Rwanda are massively productive. It's turning into a very efficient place. And was that all starting to happen when you were there in 2012, 2014?
Yeah, absolutely. My sort of the symbol for me of how efficient and hardworking government was you think of this image that diplomats are always throwing parties, and it's not exactly true, though it is sometimes true. Anyway, you could not get Rwandan officials to come to parties because they were working.
Wow.
Which was a fabulous sign to me. They were not interested in coming over to drink champagne with us. They were some of the hardest working government officials I've ever seen. I loved living there because you had sort of quite serious, quite committed partners in that respect.
What was the general feeling about looking back in the past, and particularly the relationship, I would imagine, with the U.S., when it came to the genocide and all of that stuff in the early 90s? Because they've got a very, very hard, difficult history to navigate. And they seem to have been able to put a lot of it into the experience basket and move on.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think you know ever in a case like that quite what's under the surface. Mm. And I think there's a lot of efforts to try to move on, to achieve ethnic harmony, and to move forward as the country needs to do. But there are some extraordinary institutions that work to tell this story. The Kigali Genocide Museum is an extraordinary place that tells a very difficult history and then tries to link that history with the history of other genocides in history and around the world. And I think no one can go to Rwanda without stopping there. It's not enough to go to see the gorillas in the mountains. One must go to the Genocide Museum and Memorial to have a moment of memory and reflection for what happened there. It's terrifying, and there's got to be a lesson taken from it.
Yeah, I think that too often we like to think of these things almost as, you know, a disconnected history, and particularly here on our own continent where very often it's convenient to blame people in other places for the things that we don't want to uncomfortably deal with ourselves. I think it's messy, in other words. It gets a little complex. So I saw that you started in the Foreign Service in 1994. I mean, it was like before, Bill Clinton was president, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. You know, career diplomats, you work with every administration. And so that's what I've done. And for each, it sounds cheesy, but it's been an honor to serve, right? I am proud to represent the government and proud to represent the people. It sounds canned, but true.
No, I think you have to have that attitude because you don't know what could happen. You're actually going out there to put the country's best foot forward. But what were your goals? I mean, did you think at the time when you started that you would end up being, you know, in charge of the embassy here in South Africa?
No, to the contrary. I came in very young and I saw people who'd been in for 25 years, which is almost as long as I've been now. And I thought, oh my gosh, who wants to do the same job for 25 years? But of course, it turns out it's not the same job for 25 years, that I've moved every several years, and there's been loads and loads of change and opportunities and adventures. So
where do
I have
you
not
start?
Had a chance.
Where do you start in the Foreign Service? Do you start with like a boring desk job and kind of having to read a lot of papers and fill in things? And
most of us start by doing visas.
Oh, my God.
So you say, oh, my God, but you want to know
important.
The person who does visas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, right. Mm-hmm. So South Africa and the U.S., I mean, our Home Affairs Department have, you know, for better or for worse, made it a little more complicated for U.S. visitors to come here. Definitely for worse, actually, now on reflection. How hard is it, and how many South African applications are you guys dealing with all the time? Thousands?
Thousands of applications a month, and the numbers are on the rise. And happily, those numbers also include a lot of South African students, which is super exciting. We've got some 2,000 South African students studying in the U.S.
Wow.
So those are the most fun visas, I don't doubt, to issue.
So is it very difficult for Americans to get here? Is it do you have to deal with stuff where they're having trouble in the US trying to get in here, or is that quite easy?
Pretty easy. Americans don't require visas to enter South Africa. And in fact, we get about 300,000 American visitors a year.
Wow.
And there's some 60,000.
That's a massive boost to the economy.
Massive. And there's 60,000 Americans who in fact live here. Huh. So Americans, I think, come on vacation and fall in love with South Africa, come back and stay.
If we go back to your career for a second, there's some stuff in the news at the moment about the embassy moving to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. It's a big story internationally. It's caused a lot of controversy in certain places. There's been a lot of noise and violence on the borders with Gaza. I'm curious, because you had experience of Jerusalem because you were the chief of the political section at the Consulate General there, and I imagine that must be one of the most interesting and also quite fraught places to work.
Absolutely. The issues are consuming. And I think for many people, I mean, it's almost trite, but Jerusalem is so special, right? It is special to the three major Western religions, mm-hmm. and it becomes special to individuals. And I certainly experienced that living there, the conflict is so compelling and people become so invested and engaged in it. And that was my own personal experience. It's also personally special to me because my son was in fact born in Jerusalem.
Oh, wow.
So I care about it, and I care about its history and its future. And I think it gives me actually an understanding of how deeply resonant the issue is here, that South Africa and South Africans' investment in the issue of Jerusalem and of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I understand why South Africans care so deeply and are so moved by it, because my own experience was such that it was truly compelling and important.
Do you think we're ever going to be able to sort things out there?
I do. You have to think. Yes, I do.
Got to be optimistic.
You have to be optimistic, right? You have to be optimistic because the consequences of not are too great. Too great in terms of loss of life, but also the lack of integration in the region. So I do believe it's an incredibly difficult problem, and serious and smart people have been committed. But I do believe that progress is possible. I think for me, the thing that has been disappointing in the South African decision, though, to withdraw the ambassador, is amongst the smart, serious people who have a contribution to make to the conflict and its resolution are South Africans. When I was there, we engaged a lot with Palestinians on options for nonviolent protest. And many of the important lessons that the Palestinians took were from South Africans' experience. And I don't want the withdrawal of the South African ambassador to Israel to mean South Africa can't be engaged in the region. I think South Africa has expertise and a story to share. So I would really like to see South Africa come back to the table.
I think I would too. I also think that South Africa and Israel can have a meaningful and useful bilateral relationship. We know, for example, how many great ideas have come out of Israel that have been implemented here in the private sector and in other places. So I'm on the same page there. I'm curious also, though, when you were there, are there things that at the time were so consuming that they seemed to dominate the headlines and take complete control of what the narratives were, but now in retrospect almost seem like they were not such devastating issues? Or do you get the opposite impression that actually you were dealing with things there of massive historical importance that have carried over for years since?
A lot of the issues have stayed the same, whether it's discussions of settlements or Jerusalem or borders. Those have been the consistent issues consistently. So seeing them still resonate makes you feel like there has not been progress. But in the end, the progress is between the Israeli and Palestinian parties, and the rest of us are facilitating their efforts. But that's where the progress has to be made.
Well, talking about progress, let's look at what's going on in the Koreas at the moment, because again, people may have thought that, you know, we were on our way to World War III when President Trump started tweeting and Kim Jong-un started replying, and they were calling each other names and being pretty insulting. And then suddenly you had this this sort of iconic photographic historical moment of Kim Jong-un and the South Korean President Moon busy sort of greeting each other and meeting over that demilitarized zone. Really massively historically important, because for 70 years these countries have had nothing to do with each other. And whether it was President Trump or whether it was the South Koreans or whether it was a combination of factors, which it almost always is, this is probably a hopeful moment for some kind of breakthrough in that area.
Absolutely hopeful and absolutely historic. I'm also almost mindful that the situation, it keeps changing, and by the time we air, it will have changed. But I guess what I don't think will have changed is the president's commitment on the issue, that the president is personally focused on this. Our new Secretary of State, Secretary Pompeo, similarly, we have a commitment at the leadership level to this conflict and to this problem and to digging in deeply on the details. And I think it's going to take that to solve it. So I am absolutely hopeful about this historic moment.
And what about the UN? Because you actually worked in Geneva, rather you worked with the Human Rights Council in Geneva. Mm-hmm. And the UN is a very complicated monster. I mean, it's got arms and legs and tails and ears in different places. And there are a whole lot of competing interests in the UN, and sometimes it's very effective. In the minority of cases, I would say, because there are so many things that have to happen for something to be unilaterally applicable at the UN. But in many situations, it sort of falls apart in the negotiations because you've got these competing interests. But what's it like working inside of all of that? How do you think Nikki Haley's doing, by the way?
She has a great job. So I spent 5 years working on UN issues, 2 years in Washington supporting and leading our team that was working on the Human Rights Council, and then 3 years in New York working on the Security Council. And if I think of jobs and missions that I would want to go back to, New York is one of them. And again, it's not just because I'm a New Yorker, but because every country in the world sends its best diplomats there. Mm-hmm. The most important and challenging issues of the world are addressed there. So I think she has a great job. I loved working on those issues, but it's not easy. Wow. Everybody does not always agree with us.
Yeah, I don't think anyone agrees with anyone in that place if you just look at what goes on in the General Assembly half the time. It must be also quite weird that that's in your home city. I mean, being a New Yorker, it's the center of the universe, whether people disagree or not. That's how I experience it. And I think that it's the most exciting place. It's the only place that has the energy to be able to have a site for all of these nations to interact with each other. Do you miss New York being in South Africa? How often do you get to go back?
I go back once or twice a year. I miss it. Of course, everybody misses their home. But I'm also a little in love with Johannesburg in particular. I think Joburg has
a great
vibe.
Most people fall in love with Cape Town. They don't care about Joburg.
Joburg has a great vibe. It's an urban, urban city. I love it.
And Pretoria? I mean, that's where you live, right?
I live there, and I will say that if anyone is in Brooklyn, Pretoria, they should drive by my house. There's usually a lemonade stand out front. We are truly bringing America to Pretoria in my household. Yep.
What kind of school do you get to send your kid to? I mean, does he have a normal life with a mom who's got an important job like this?
I hope he would say he does. He goes to the American school in Pretoria and loves it. I think he gets frustrated that I'm gone a lot, that I'm working a lot. On the other hand, I wouldn't want him not to be proud of me. I wouldn't want him to feel like I didn't try to impact the world as much as I could. And I hope that he will take from me that he should impact the world. But also that women they're the same expectations on women as there are on men to do whatever you can to make the world a better place.
How do you think U.S. and South African relations are at the moment? And what do you think we could do to improve them? So, it's in both of our interests.
Absolutely. And we are happily engaging and working with the new dispensation and are enthusiastic about the focus on transparency, anti-corruption, and an improved investment climate. For us, that's very, very welcome. The other great thing in the relationship is actually not at the government-to-government relationship, but all of the exciting work that's happening at the people-to-people level or the institution-to-institution level. I just went last week to the launch at WITS of a new center for the study of the United States. Hmm. It's the first sub-Saharan African center for the study of the U.S., and that, though it got significant funding from us, very much represents the energy and connectivity between U.S. and South African institutions.
What's the best part of the job?
Honestly, the best part of the job is engaging with South African youth, whether it's through the Mandela Washington Fellowship or the Fulbright Program or our other exchanges. We have a long history of exchange programs. In the late 80s, we sent one young Cyril Ramaphosa on an exchange program to the U.S.
Now, that's interesting. I wonder how many people know about that.
It's terrific. We've got a good track record of selecting. And I think engaging with those young people, I can't meet with all of them. They're 200 a year. But I really try to meet with as many as I can because those interactions leave me inspired and optimistic about South Africa and about the American South African future.
Now, what about having an ambassador? I mean, can't President Trump either appoint you or send us somebody, or what's the delay? What's going on here?
Okay, you've been talking to my mom.
Surely, I mean, just, you know, give her the job. She's proven herself. I'm talking to you, Mr. President.
So the president, I think, you know, in our system, the president will he'll nominate, the Senate will confirm.
Right.
And when that happens, that person will have a terrific deputy.
Right.
In the meanwhile, I'll stay as chargé, and I'm blessed because I have an extraordinary team. We're 1,200 people, American diplomats, many of our American specialized agencies, local South African staff. We're in Pretoria, Cape Town, Durban, and Johannesburg. And we are doing it and working closely with Washington and look forward to the president nominating a new ambassador. But I'm here till then.
Yeah, no, well, look, I'm not complaining. I'm not saying there's anything wrong, but it would be nice if he'd just make a decision about it. I know that we're low down on his priority list out of all the things he has to do at the moment. Well, Jesse, there's lots of other stuff that we could get into, but I did want to cover a majority of the things that we've already brought up during this discussion. And I think that we've got a 4th of July coming up, which I'm sure is always a reason for the whole diplomatic community to get together at the U.S. Embassy and have some fun. Are there any plans for you or for the embassy in the next while to involve themselves in things that we don't know about yet? Are there big programs being launched that you want to give us a, you know, peek at?
Absolutely. We are enthusiastically supporting and participating in South Africa's Mandela Centenary Year.
He was quite a big deal for us, Nelson Mandela. He really was.
The legacy of Mandela is an extraordinary one. It's a legacy of commitment to youth, to idealism, to engaging with those you don't agree with. And so this centenary year and the focus on service, on ethical leadership, this is a place that we really want to participate in and support. And our big signature event for the centenary is actually the first major American orchestra to ever tour South Africa. And what I love is that this initiative came from Americans in Minnesota themselves, that we didn't drive it, and they will host in July, on the centenary, they'll host a concert in the U.S. with South African artists, and then they will tour the country in August, all in celebration.
Fantastic. That's very cool. I also got an invitation just the other day the Nelson Mandela Memorial Lecture is going to be former President Barack Obama.
Yes.
That's exciting. People in this country love him, and I love him. I think he was great.
Very exciting that he's coming. We at the embassy aren't really organizing the trip because it's organized with the Obama Foundation and the Nelson Mandela Foundation. But it's really exciting, and I think really is part of an amazing connection between the last, let's say, four American presidents and Mandela, going back to George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W., and then Barack Obama. All of them really had a connection, whether it was around PEPFAR or at the Mandela funeral. There was a sense of true personal connection between each of our leaders and Madiba.
And President Obama came here a few times. He liked coming here. He seems to have had a really great relationship with this country. And obviously we're pleased to welcome him back. Very cool. And it's going to be one of those events that everybody's going to talk about for a long time, I should think. He's also a great speaker and will have things to say that no doubt will have a resonance here in South Africa. So, lots of stuff to get into, and there's obviously plenty more information. If people want to get hold of the U.S. representatives here in South Africa, they're always open to discuss things, to give you info. If you want to know more about the work that PEPFAR are doing, you can just contact them. They're very easy to find. And
please,
they've also got social media. You guys are all over social media. Yeah. U.S. Embassy S.A.
U.S. Embassy S.A. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook or, increasingly, Instagram.
Right. Got to put up those pictures. Thank you so much. Jesse Le Pen is the U.S. Embassy's Charge d'Affaires here in South Africa. And thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to us. It's always nice to have you around.
Thanks so much, Gareth.
This is CliffCentral.com.